Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got BYU's honor code and the political conventions, much more. Joining me in studio, Tribune political reporter Lee Davidson is with us. Lee, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us, political columnist Paul Raleigh joins us. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
And justice reporter Aaron Alberti is here. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind as well. For comments, you can put those online, sltrib.com. You can tweet using the hashtag TribTalk. You can also call us live. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. For several weeks, the Tribune has been chasing the story of how Brigham Young University handles rape cases with respect to its honor code. And this week, Aaron, you reported some more facets of the story. Let's start with one of the first women to come forward to you, Madeline McDonald. Can you recount her story briefly?
Yeah, Madeline McDonald was sexually assaulted. She said on a blind date in, I want to say, December of 2014. She'd gone in a car she'd gone with a guy, a blind date, up to some mountain in Orem. She thought that they were just going to go out for cocoa or something, she said. But he ended up driving up to this mountain in Orem. He started kissing her and stuff. And then he started pushing things like way far, way fast, more than she wanted to. She said she was trying to fight him off and move his hands away and telling him no, but that he just wasn't hearing it. She got to the point where she was like, okay, just don't antagonize him. Let him get over with this as soon as he, you know, get it over with as quickly as possible and hope that I don't get hurt kind of situation. She said she reported it to the Center for the Women's Resource Center at BYU. They directed her to Title IX. She also made a police report with Orem Police because that's the jurisdiction, not BYU Police. But she said when she was sent to Title IX that they did an investigation about it, and then they told her that her investigation was being forwarded to the Honor Code Office, which she was surprised about because the accused assailant in her case was not a student. The only person for the Honor Code to investigate was her. And she said that, you know, this was a daytime, you know, it wasn't after the hours that they're supposed to be hanging out with people or in somebody's home. It wasn't in a home. It was on a mountain. She was complying with dress code because it was December. I mean, she wasn't running around in no sleeves or anything. She wasn't drinking. There were no drugs. There was no allegation of an honor code violation, and yet her name being the only person that they could look at was forwarded to the Honor Code Office, she said, was really surprising to her.
So she gets groped. She escapes. She reports. And the same day, the Honor Code Office investigates or opens this investigation. How does BYU explain that?
Well, so basically, she found out about the timing of the Honor Code investigation because she submitted a FERPA request for the file from the Honor Code Office. And that's how she saw that the date on the like intake date or the open date on the file was the same day that she made the report to the Title IX office, which is... I guess it would be apparently contradictory to some of the statements that BYU has made that the investigation by the Title IX office and the investigation by the Honor Code office are separate. When I talked to BYU about it, their spokesperson explained that they used the same tracking system for Honor Code stuff as they do for Title IX. They were instructed to do some different stuff with Title IX investigations, and since they already had the system set up for Honor Code, they just used the same system for Title IX. She said just because that's the open date doesn't mean that's when the investigation begins on the Honor Code side, but the Honor Code file did have all of the contents of the Title IX investigation, like statements from the guy that she said she was on this date with and everything.
And Madeline, obviously troubled by all of this information about her. They were collecting a tremendous amount of information, and she feels completely vindicated. She did nothing.
Yeah, they found that she, you know, they didn't find any violations. They did clear her in the assault against her. But the thing that she was most startled by was when she went through and found materials that she didn't really think had anything to do with whether she was sexually assaulted or potential honor code violations. There were records of a phone call from her father, for example, complaining that why is my kid being investigated by the honor code when she was assaulted? There were, she said that every conversation she'd had with receptionists in the honor code office, like where she'd made little kind of like jokes or something with a receptionist, that those entire conversations and those little jokes were sort of transcribed and put in her file. And she said, maybe most startlingly, was that she had gone to student government representatives to complain about this, that victims and sex crimes would be investigated for honor code violations, and asked them to push this as an issue and try to get it changed. And the representative that she spoke with had sent a text message to somebody, it's not clear who, saying, hey, this girl is here talking about this. She's pretty frustrated. I'd say her likelihood of going to the media or to a local government official is high. I mean, I can't say word for word what it was, because she was not allowed to make photocopies or take images or even take another person with her.
But the gist
to look at the file.
This is a warning. They put a red flag on her for some reason.
Yeah, she said that the file went beyond that. The school said that the honor code will just retain whatever materials are sent to them. If somebody sent them something, they'll put it in the file, even if it didn't figure into their investigation.
Hmm. You also had another story this week about a woman who was raped and who says that her attacker used the honor code as a way to prevent her from going to authorities. Can you tell us about Julie's story?
Yeah, I actually talked to several women who had experiences with this. But Julie was a student there. I believe she said her assault happened in 2012. It was somebody she was seeing casually, a neighbor. And she had been... Previously, she'd been in his apartment after the hours that you're allowed to be in the apartment of a member of the opposite sex. But it started out as a consensual makeout session, and then he completely ignores her, stop, I'm done, no more. And she said he threw her on a beanbag and raped her. Then afterward, she confronted him. He wanted to see her again, and she said, you know what you did. You know you raped me. This is, like, you know. And he said that if she were to report him to the police, that he would report her to the honor code office. He would make them believe that it was consensual. She'd broken some honor code rules, like the timing of being in the apartment and whatnot. Anyway... And she said, even if those things didn't matter, he could tell them that she was losing faith in the LDS church, which, to go to BYU, if you start out at BYU as a member of the LDS church, you have to stay in good standing with the church in order to keep your ecclesiastical recommend.
So she really took this threat to heart. And as you've been interviewing local law enforcement about this, they say the BYU honor code is just one more way that rapists are coercing victims into silence.
Yeah, I mean, basically the world over, predators will find ways to leverage their victims. They'll threaten telling family. They'll threaten telling employers. Talking to law enforcement in Utah County about this, specifically the Provo Police Department had a lot to say about this, that they've found that this is just, yeah, it's one more thing. And it's to call it one more thing is a little bit, it's a lot of things, because the honor code is very specific and very sweeping. It covers a lot of different behaviors. It covers a lot of different, you know, there are a lot of ways you can violate the honor code. What the actual punishment would be for different violations isn't quite clear. It's not like they have, you know, a little matrix of this violation leads to this punishment. But when you're a victim of a violent crime and you're already feeling vulnerable, and likely in many of these women that I've talked to, and I'll say men too at this point, I've talked to a few different men, there's a lot of feeling of shame and guilt associated with it for a lot of these people. So the idea of being then punished, even for a small violation, is very disturbing, and it really compounds the vulnerability that they feel.
Mm-hmm. This story has absolutely exploded online. Paul Raleigh, you are no fan of BYU, but how bad is this for the institution?
Well, excuse me. It's already, I think, caused a lot of damage PR-wise for the school. And I think the school has been too slow to respond to this and maybe take seriously some of the problems that this honor code issue brings up. But I'll tell you a little anecdote, and because Aaron's story about the perpetrators using the honor code or using the membership of the LDS Church as a weapon against their victims to keep them silent. It reminds me, a few years ago, there was a pretty high-profile Republican kind of Tea Party guy. His name was Greg Peterson, and he had started the Rocky Mountain Conservatives Coalition, and he would have these events at his cabin. I want to say in Heber City, and he would bring, Orrin Hatch, Mitt Romney, a lot of real high-profile Republicans would go to these events, and it was a kind of a to get them more in line with the Tea Party idea and that sort of thing. And he ended up being charged with, he was being accused of being a serial rapist, and he would find his victims on LDS websites or dating sites, and he'd meet them, and then he'd somehow manipulate them and take them up to his cabin and then rape them. And then he would use that very thing, would say if they said anything or anything else, he would get them in trouble with their bishops or their church, or because they did this wrong or did that wrong. And that actually went on for a while. He had several, victims. And then finally they started coming out, and he was charged with, I believe, 25 counts of sexual assault. And he had a very high bail, and then he met the bail, and they let him out of jail, but he had an ankle bracelet so he wouldn't run. And he ended up killing himself while he was waiting trial. But her stories about using that as a weapon just brought back memories of this guy and this story, and it makes you wonder how often this happens.
Absolutely. Aaron, BYU has responded. They said they will be reviewing policies. There's been a broad support for an amnesty clause. Do we have any indication when this review is happening, who's reviewing it, when the public will know what this revised Honors Code policy looks like?
Well, we don't know that there will be a revision to the honor code. We don't know if there are going to be policy revisions. We really don't know what they're going to do, and we don't know what the time frame is for studying it. Last week, the president of the university announced in a video, and the school announced in a statement, that they were going to be studying potential procedural and structural changes to the honor code. One of those things that she did specifically say, when I raised the questions about Madeline McDonald's case, when she looked through her file and saw that it appeared to have been opened on the same day, that there seemed to be no distinction between the Title IX and the honor code investigation, was that the software overlap, the system, the tracking system that they used, would be looked at as a potential structural change. Of course, that's not the same thing as amnesty, and that doesn't really address what people are saying. But that was just one example. You know, they have not that does not exclude the possibility that something else could happen.
Fantastic reporting. Keep digging. We will continue to monitor. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Headspin Events, presenting the 5th annual Cache Grand Fondo bike ride through Cache Valley and ending in downtown Logan. To benefit Logan Regional Hospital, Saturday, July 9th, registration information available at cachegrandfondo.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Actors Dev Patel and Jeremy Irons star in a new film about a real-life Indian math prodigy and a Cambridge professor.
We are merely explorers of infinity in the pursuit of absolute perfection.
I owe you so much.
No. It's I who owe you.
They'll join us. That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Joining me today in studio, Paul Raleigh, Aaron Alberti, Benjamin Wood has joined us, education reporter, and Lee Davidson, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. And if you want to join us, we're talking about the week's top stories. You can send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, comment online, sltrib.com, or call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Last week, we got a political party convention forecast. This week, we know what happened. Lee, you were there. Describe the showdown between Governor Gary Herbert and his intra-party rival, Jonathan Johnson.
Well, Jonathan Johnson surprised a lot of people. He won a majority of the votes, 55% to 45%. That forces Governor Herbert into a primary election race. Even though he has one of the highest approval rates of any governor in the nation, he finds himself in a primary. Johnson had attacked him very vigorously and gave a very good speech at the convention, complained about Herbert's tax increases, not standing up to the federal government and selling out the party's convention system, the traditional one. The governor had used a new system to automatically qualify for the primary by collecting enough signatures. That's allowed in a new law that was a compromise, and a lot of convention delegates hate that. They like the convention system. They're delegates. And they punished him a bit for that. They punished some other people, too. State Senator Kurt Bramble wrote that new law, and he finds himself in a primary also. He had also collected signatures to make sure it'd be okay, but he's in a primary. Mm. And like I said, it was a bit of a surprise.
Herbert, as you noted, has very, very high approval ratings in amongst the general population. So this convention result does seem to validate a study that you reported on by the Utah Foundation. Can you just tell us about that report very quickly?
Yeah, it says that delegates tend to be more extreme than typical voters in a party. On the Republican side, they're much more conservative. Democratic side, they're much more liberal. And that kind of bears out if you look at the results. They do tend to vote more to the extreme.
Raleigh, you were there as well. And you reported this week that there was an incident involving super glue that may have hampered Governor Herbert's supporters out at the convention. What happened?
The Herbert campaign had had parked a U-Haul in front of the Salt Palace the night before the convention, and they had all their campaign signs inside the U-Haul, and then they planned to that morning before the convention go in there and place the campaign signs in strategic areas in the convention hall. And that's always a big deal with campaigns, and they want to make sure that their candidate is, you know, visible to the delegates as they come in and see the signs and everything else. And so when they got there at 6 o'clock in the morning to do that, somebody had put super glue in the lock of the U-Haul, and they couldn't get the lock open. And they were scurrying around, you know, looking for cutters to cut the lock so they could get it open. It was 6 in the morning, so it was, you know, hard to find a place that would have something like that. And in the meantime, Jonathan Johnson and other candidates, you know, they got their signs out of their storage areas and filled up the hall with their signs. By the time the Herbert campaign got the U-Haul open and got their signs in there, all the strategic areas had been taken. And so they had to find, you know, secondary areas or places that would not be as visible to the delegates and anybody else coming in. And so, yeah, it was
Who's
it was
claiming
a pretty...
responsibility, Raleigh? Because that sounds like high school pranks.
Yeah, the Johnson campaign denies any responsibility, but it has to make you wonder. I mean, particularly in intra-party fights and convention fights and stuff, you kind of see this juvenile sort of stuff happen quite a bit. But, to me, this what Lee mentioned about the study and that delegates tend to be more extreme, that's true. And to me, it's kind of an argument for the a direct primary system, at least this compromise to allow people to go through the petition process, because like the very conservative guy, he beats Herbert, a popular governor in the convention. Well, this has happened before, Olene Walker had a 84% approval rating when she was the governor in 2004, and she got ousted by the delegates. And so
Senator Bob Bennett comes to mind.
Senator Bob Bennett got ousted at the convention, and now we have Mike Lee. But most people who have studied that and observed that would say that if Bennett would have been, if the voters, the Republican voters in the Republican primary would have had a chance to vote for Bennett, he would have won easily. But these few handful of delegates, relatively handful of delegates, precluded, the more general Republican population from having a choice. I'll go back to 1992 when Governor Bangor declined to run for a third term, and it was an open seat, and you had several people running for governor. And that was the year that Mike Leavitt won the election. But in the convention, he got beat by Richard Iyer, who was the very extreme right-wing candidate. But Iyer did not have enough to eliminate him at the convention, and so once it got to a primary, Leavitt easily won. And then Leavitt in 2000 was forced into a primary again. In fact, that was the convention that he got booed by the delegates because he wasn't weird enough, I guess. But
I guess Herbert actually some strong reaction during his very fiery speech, Lee.
Well, actually, the week before the Utah County Convention, the governor was booed. Again, it was delegates who didn't like the fact that he had gathered signatures, and they were upset with that. And there are a lot of delegates who are very concerned about things like homeschooling, and they think that he has caved into federal and other pressure for Common Core, and that's an unpopular thing. And Johnson has pushed fighting Common Core a lot, which plays very well with a lot of delegates. Mm.
Can we just quickly review what happened on the Democratic side? Both of the parties held their convention at the Saul Palace, so you could sort of run back and forth at the same time.
In fact, the Democratic chairman was seen walking through the Republican side, and all the delegates were handing him material, and he was politely accepting it as he walked back to the Democratic side.
I talked to one Democrat who said that a lot of Republicans were coming to their side because of the free food. So there you go.
Better party on that side. So you have to check it out.
Democrats overwhelmingly supported Mike Weinholz as their candidate for governor. But then during his speech, he revealed a bit of a bombshell. What did he say, Lee?
That his wife is being investigated for using marijuana. He says it's for medical use, that she uses it to handle pain, and that they had been told by Salt Lake City police that she's being investigated. And so before the vote happened, he announced that. He said he wanted to run a transparent campaign so delegates should know about it. He had a partial standing ovation and was applauded. And his opponent, who he eliminated, named Vaughn Cook, actually said that he had considered using medical marijuana because of cancer pain himself. And so he doesn't want to criticize people who do it. And so that was an interesting twist over there. There's another interesting twist in another race over there.
Okay, go ahead.
On the nomination race for the Senate, Jonathan Swinton is running against Misty Snow. There's a primary there. Swinton was not left enough on abortion. He's LDS. He's kind of taking the same stand as the LDS church and said that's what most Utahns want. Snow is very much more to the left, attacked him vigorously on that, and put him into a primary. Mm. And Snow is interesting because she is transgender, and if she got the nomination, we're pretty sure that she'd be the first transgender candidate in Utah to have a nomination for that high of an office. Mm. So it's an interesting race to watch.
Well, definitely an interesting race to watch. Back to the Weinholz revelation. Paul Raleigh, you were in the audience before the partial standing ovation. A bit of a surprise.
Well, people were surprised. There was a little bit of a surprise there, and then they supported him.
How's this going to play with the electorate?
Well, that's a good question because there are a lot of people on the conservative side who favor medical marijuana. I mean, one of the most conservative people in the entire legislature, Senator Mark Madsen, was the guy who sponsored that bill twice because he himself was undergoing a lot of back pains and that sort of thing. And he went over to Colorado, and medical marijuana was about the only thing that could soothe his pain and alleviate anything. So he's become very passionate. Now, the interesting thing about him being such a passionate supporter of medical marijuana, he's Ezra Taft Benson's grandson. And so there's—
Former LDS church president.
Church president, yeah. And so— for someone of that stature within the LDS Church to be so passionate and in favor of it, it's not just a liberal idea, I don't think. There's a libertarian thread, I think, in the Republican Party that also favors that sort of thing.
If you want to join us, we're talking about the week's top stories. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Randy in St. George. He is a delegate. And Randy, sorry, we're getting our phones straight. Randy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I got in the car and heard this radio and jumped through the roof because I left both the county and the state convention very frustrated and very upset. And I know there's a big argument about the delegate and the petitions and so on. And I had two experiences that really, really upset me. One was in the county convention. We had Gil Almquist, former city manager, running for county commissioner, and Dean Cox running. And Gil had gone the petition route to guarantee that he'd be on the ballot, and Dean did not. And after the first ballot, I voted for Gil, and that's what our precinct had wanted. And on the second vote, I voted for Dean because he did not do the petition. He had put his entire faith in the way the party wants to run through the delegate system. As we know, they're fighting that in the courts. And with my vote swing, it came out 247-247. He is now on the ballot for the primary. We saw the same thing happen in the Herbert campaign. What upset me the most at the national delegate candidate level was the people who were running for national delegates were at the convention in the state pledging to vote for Ted Cruz no matter what, for every single vote at the national convention, which to me meant we had mayhem in the party. And I emailed every single candidate and said I would vote for you if you would honor your first vote to what your area wants, and after that you would vote for whoever has the most delegates so that we don't have a contested convention. I only heard back from 10 of 100 of delegates that would do that. And at the convention, I stood up and protested a signed form that was being passed out by Ted Cruz with names of delegates that were running for national delegates that would guarantee to pledge all of their votes to Ted Cruz And the bylaws of the Utah Republican Convention say that a national delegate shall be bound on the first vote, but shall not pledge or allocate their votes on subsequent votes. And I had some other people who spoke to some of the delegates that were on the Ted Cruz list, and they said they had not signed it or had signed it at the request of Mike Lee. And I really feel that it's unfair that the Republican Party, when they're fighting so hard to keep the delegate system, looks fondly on candidates who are circumventing it with petitions and not allowing the delegate system to work as it is. So it needs to be changed. There needs to be better laws. But there is a lot of coercion going on. I saw it. We hear about it in the news. It is happening, and there are delegates that are pledging to be national delegates that are pledging their entire votes to specific people. And I think no matter who's on top after that first vote, whether it's Cruz or whether it's somebody else, we need to get behind that person, honor the delegate system. We're doing the same thing that was done to Mitt Romney internally in our party against people like Trump. And I think it's kind of double standard. So,
Randy, thank you so much. I really appreciate the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Reaction to Randy's comments, Lee?
Well, there are two main slates running for national candidates. He mentioned the one slate that they vowed to support Cruz at all costs through all possible votes. They won big. All but two candidates for national delegate were part of that slate. There's another slate called Stop Trump, Stop Clinton. They vowed to support Cruz on the first vote, and then after that, you know, it was just whoever would be the best candidate. They didn't win. So there's a lot of interest in the they love Cruz, the delegates did, and so that showed up in the final vote.
Randy, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go back to the phones. Brent calling from Sandy. Brent, you've been patient. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. I just wanted to call just before your last commercial break. You had a gentleman talking about the situation with BYU, and I just cannot believe the ridiculous comment. I heard him comparing BYU to a known rapist and making ignorant comments, when he knows very well that BYU does not release information to the public from what they've found out. So I found that to be absolutely ignorant and completely asinine to make a comment comparing BYU to a rapist.
All right. Brent, you've been heard. Thanks very much. Paul, you want to defend yourself?
Yeah, I didn't compare BYU to a rapist. You know, people tend to hear what they want to hear. I was talking about using that church affiliation as a weapon by rapists, and I gave the example of Greg Peterson, who did that, and he would find his victims on LDS websites, and so that's something that ought to be looked at. I never compared BYU to a rapist, so you know. He can have his problems, but I don't care.
Thanks for the clarity. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's move on to another topic, charter schools. A new report looked at charter school funding. Benjamin Wood, what were the findings?
Simply put, the findings were that school district schools do in fact get more money per student than charter schools. This was Utah Foundation report. They included a pretty big asterisk in that they said, yes, districts get more money, but they also might need more money because of certain disadvantages. And that's something that is talked about anecdotally a lot in education. And this was the first report to really kind of nail that in specific terms.
What do you mean? It's unfair, but it's not wholly unfair?
Right. It's the issue of equality versus equity. And the best comparison I can make, and it's an incomplete comparison, but if you imagine a family with two children, a 5-year-old and a 15-year-old, and they're trying to set a curfew, you know, you could say that equal would be they go to bed at the same time. Equitable would be the 15-year-old stays up a little later. So the idea is that school districts have services, programs, requirements that don't apply to charter schools that carry a cost. And so for a certain extent, you expect them to receive more funding to complete those requirements.
So, for example, a lot of charter schools don't have to cater to language barriers that a lot of public schools have to deal with if they've got a school with, you know, 50 different languages from new immigrant families. Charter schools in general don't have to deal with that, and that does require resources.
Yeah, and it's not that charter schools don't have to provide those services. It's just that by nature of the self-selecting population at charter school, you just don't see the same level of diversity. And the numbers of the Utah Foundation Report bear that out. I mean, charter schools are wider, they are more affluent, they are more English-speaking, and they have, just by nature, parents who are more involved in their children's education.
Hmm. So we've seen a lot of growth in charter schools in recent years. What does this all mean for traditional public school funding and for education as a whole?
Whenever we write about the enrollment growth, I always ask the charter organizations when they think that number might plateau. We're at 1 in 10 students now in charter schools, and no one really knows. About every year we get 10 or a dozen or so new charter schools. We've closed two ever. We're now at a little more than 100 schools total. And so there seems to be this expectation that at some point the people who want charter schools will have them and will have a saturation. But when that will occur is hard to say.
What kind of response are we getting to this report?
I think for the education community, there's not a lot of surprises in the report. Like I said, this has been a discussion that's been happening and been referenced to. And so I think for most of the educators, this report just sort of confirms the picture that they've been trying to describe for several years.
Raleigh, how do you think policymakers are going to use this information? If it's nothing new, it sort of validates what the assumptions out there are.
There are more than a dozen. There will be people in the legislature who will use this as arguments there for more money for charter schools. There are, I don't know the number, but there are, I'm sure, more than a dozen current and former legislators who, in one way or another, make money and make income off of charter schools. So there's been over the years that I've seen some real personal interests, coming legislators' way as charter schools get, more and more funding and more mainstream and grow. I think that there seems to have been a personal agenda among some legislators to push for more and more money, more and more funding for charter schools. When early on in the charter school development, the people who were supporting it, Howard Stevenson, the senator, is one of the big supporters, were saying that charter schools, one of the arguments for it was that they could operate more cheaply than public schools, and that was a big plus for them. And then ever since then, they've been saying the charter schools are getting the short end of the stick and doing things to get more and more funding shifted away from school districts and into charter schools in those areas.
Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen the report, if you want some more background, go to sltrib.com. Ben, another story you reported this week: University of Utah finding itself in some hot water for bestowing an honorary degree to a woman for her public health work, but really downplaying her involvement in more controversial groups. So what's the story?
Lynette Nielsen Gay, she is a philanthropist. She's founded some charities that do health and education advocacy in Africa. And she also has a history of serving in leadership positions on the World Congress of Families and Family Watch International, which are two pro-traditional family groups in their description, or anti-LGBT hate groups by other groups' description. And when her bio was released, the university puts out a list of their honorary degree recipients, and her original bio included those groups. Subsequent changes to that bio have removed the references to those groups. And so some,
So you asked about that, didn't you?
Yeah, we did.
Ben?
First some eagle-eyed, Ute fans noticed that was on her bio. You started seeing some comments being added to the university's website. We received a letter from a gentleman in the community. And so we asked some questions, and ultimately a spokesperson for the university said that, yeah, the university does not support the work of those two groups, but Mrs. Gay is being honored for her charitable work. And so her bio was changed to reflect what she's being honored for.
So LGBT supporters, are they asking that the university not go through with this honorary degree? Is there Is that idea getting any traction?
I don't know if it's going to get any traction. I mean, certainly at the university's website, at our website, in our comment section, there have been a lot of people saying that you know, Mrs. Gay should not be honored by the university at all, that her experience with these groups disqualifies her. As far as whether or not the university is, you know, considering that, it doesn't appear that they're reconsidering their award, but you know, but they did acknowledge that, you know, those groups are not aligned with the university's values.
What does Mrs. Gay have to say for herself?
I have not had a chance to speak to her. We reached out to her charitable groups. We tried to get in touch with her, and we're still waiting to hear.
Okay.
I would love her to email me, bwood@sltrib.com, if she's
okay,
listening.
Okay, there you go. Raleigh, what do you think? Should the U back down?
You know, this woman has had a lot of accomplishments, and I understand the angst over being on a board of some of these groups, particularly groups that have been identified by the Southern Law Poverty Center as hate groups. I think you need to look at her in the entire context. Now, this World Conference of Families, they had a convention here, as I recall,
they did,
recently,
yeah.
And that
mm-hmm.
that was a lot of controversy too. But pretty high members in the LDS Church who were invited to speak or have had some association with these groups, and I think you shouldn't be too knee-jerky about making someone disqualified for being involved. And my guess would be that a lot of her involvement, like with the World Conference of Families and stuff, might have had something to do with her LDS activities. And they've had a history of having concerns about same-sex marriage and that sort of thing. And so I'd give her a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. I mean, she is a very accomplished woman if you look at her entire resume.
Mm-hmm. Ben Wood, when is graduation?
It's next Thursday.
Okay. Stay tuned. SLTrib.com. If you want to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to Carl from St. George. And Carl, welcome.
How are you, folks?
Hi.
May I go back to the BYU rape situation?
Sure.
I'd like to pose a question to your expert there. I haven't heard the whole program, but apparently you do have experts. Do you think that a woman ever participates in or contributes to her own rape? Now, let me give you a further example of what I mean.
Very quickly. We're running out of time, Carl.
Okay, by her body language or the things that she says, she creates the wind and then subsequently reaps the whirlwind. Is that what's wrong with that question or statement?
Carl, thanks for the call. Paul Raleigh.
When a woman says no, she means no. And if anything that happens after that is an illegal sexual assault, period.
Aaron Alberti.
Yeah, you can read the story that we ran this week. I mean, the police officer from Provo was very clear. Any non-consensual sexual activity is criminal, regardless of anything that happened before it.
No means no. That's what consent means. Carl, thanks very much for that call. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take another break. We'll be right back.
I'm Jill Deacon. At last, Drake has bestowed his new album, Views, upon the world. Next time on Q, we'll convene a...
What happens when someone who hates welfare becomes the head of a welfare department?
I've seen so much damage to people that are on welfare. They have no hope for a better future. They aren't setting a good example for their children.
I'm Adrienne Hill. A new series that looks at what welfare is now and how it's changed. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Benjamin Wood, would you like to kick us off?
I'd love to. If you're a movie fan like me, you're probably following the Broovies Deadpool controversy.
Love it.
Our colleague Sean Means had a column, I believe yesterday, reporting that for the next month, Broovies' free Monday night movie series is going to be civil rights oriented. They're going to be showing Footloose and The Majestic and The People vs. Larry Flint. So as a nice kind of signal to the DABC, they'll be fighting against the man every night on Monday night for the next month.
The question is, do any of those films have nudity? Will they be serving alcohol during the performances?
Well, I can tell you Footloose doesn't have nudity. And, I would imagine they were carefully chosen.
No sex there. Okay, very good. Lee Davidson, what's your pick?
I pick one by our colleague Robert Gerke in today's newspaper. It's about so-called speed dating by Governor Gary Herbert.
If we had had more time, I would have talked about it, but it's a great story. Go ahead.
Right. If donors give him a certain amount of money, they get 20 minutes of FaceTime with the governor where they can talk about whatever they like. A lot of people think he's gone too far here, that this is money for FaceTime and, you know, it doesn't smell right. And he's doing it in part because he's now in a primary race and he needs to raise more money.
Mm-hmm. He's going to be fundraising like crazy before June, right?
He has a lot of fundraisers, and as an incumbent governor, he's able to raise a lot of money.
Check out that story in today's sltrib.com. Paul Raleigh, what's your underplayed story?
We had a story a little while back from Mia Love, where she was saying that she's got so much money and she's so well off and she's doing so well that she doesn't need to take money from the Republican National Congressional Committee, like most people do. It was kind of a surprising story. It's very rare that you see politicians say that they don't need to take any money from anybody who wants to give them money. And then in the New York Times just recently, there was a story that I kind of connected the dots to that said that the Republican National Congressional Committee has chosen not to give donations very much to people because they don't have that much money right now. So they have kind of cut off the spigot. So I guess the question here is, what was first, the chicken or the egg? Did she decide she didn't need any more money after they decided they weren't going to give her any more money?
How convenient.
Or was it the other way around?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Erin Alberty.
On our website today, we have a story about more graffiti in southern Utah and natural wonders, this time at Arches National Park. It's on Frame Arch, which is a viewpoint of Delicate Arch, of course, with the one on the license plate. But a really big and deep
See the image at sltrib.com. It's actually very disturbing to me.
Yeah, it's just, you know, we've had a few of these lately. Of course, recently, Zebra Arch. And I just recently did a hike of the week to a sand dune arch where there was a whole segment that I was hoping to go play with my daughter, and they'd actually, like, roped off part of the park because the graffiti was so excessive there. Mm. And they had an image of a rock there that had been carved with, like, scores of initials and hearts and couples that are probably broken up.
And the rangers say that social media seems to be fueling this new vandalism.
Yeah, but they're also saying they hope that social media will be punishing toward people who vandalize and that it will exert social pressure on people not to do this. I don't know what it will take, but it's definitely, I know we're not to editorialize, but it's very disappointing to me as a lover of hikes in southern Utah.
My underplayed story, I actually have two. One of my favorites this week, Lee Davidson wrote about common items confiscated by the TSA at the airport, and there are grenades on that list, like multiple grenades. Lee, what is going on?
They say they find them all the time. It's pretty common.
That is just so...
They're finding a lot of guns, too, yeah. Probably from people who want to defend themselves against the people carrying grenades.
Right.
Grenades make great paperweights.
That's a puzzle to me. The other one, Catherine Reese Newton wrote a lovely piece about the Utah Symphony performing at Carnegie Hall in New York. If you haven't had a chance, check it out, sltrib.com. Erin Alberty, Lee Davidson, Benjamin Wood, and Paul Raleigh of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby considers children taking their parents to court.
I didn't even know that was possible. But yeah, in Arkansas, this was back in 2010, a 14-year-old boy sued his mom for slander. And he got a lawyer and took her to court.
If you had known about that as a possibility when you were a kid, would you have sued your parents?
Right, you bet. I would have. Well, I don't know about suing. I would have sued just my mom because I wouldn't expect, you know, physical retaliation from her.
You think you might have gotten a whooping from your dad if you'd sued him?
Well, yeah. I mean, your parents tell everybody, people, things about you if they should be warned, you know, like, be careful with my son, he's a biter, that sort of thing. So if they really care about the people they're introducing you to, they're going to give them a heads up about what he'll go to the bathroom anywhere.
You got to read part of this column back from 2010.
So this is about what your parents say about you. The old man had absolutely no qualms about telling people the worst sort of things imaginable about me. He called it fair warning, but it was slander. Case in point, when my parents took me to my first day of school, we went in and sat down with a teacher. When she began introducing herself, my father cut her off. "He'll bite you," he said, holding me up by my scruff. "I am not kidding. Don't turn your back on him for a second." This was slander. True, I had bitten all of my siblings, most of their friends, and everybody at church, but never a teacher. My mom tried to stick up for me. While she and the old man got into a heated discussion about the mailman incident, Mrs. Miller gave me a look that said she had clearly identified the enemy. It set the entire tone for my public education.
Do you think that your daughters would have sued you for slander?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they probably would have won. Because by the time they got up into their late teens, I was already a newspaper columnist, and I was telling everybody in the world about stuff they'd done. And while some of it was true, there was some that wasn't, that I did just to get even.
Little embellishment.
Little embellishments, yes.
That is Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all the Kirby archives online, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Bennett Purser, and Jessica Sonderegger at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. Just a program note, thanks to everyone for joining us last night to celebrate the Pulitzer Prizes at Trolley Square. We had a great party, a fantastic cake. You can see images and video online, sltrib.com. And the program will be rebroadcast right here on KCPW next Friday. So a week from today, 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. So check it out. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week. Jill Deacon. At last, Drake has bestowed his new album, Views, upon the world. Next time on Q, we'll convene a panel of music pros to give us their first takes on the record and discuss why Drake has become the phenomenon that he is. That is coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.